to the Pink Flyer.
David Gilmour, guitariste et chef de Pink Floyd, avec Rick Wright, organiste, Roger Waters, bassiste, et Nick Mason, batteur.
If I can remember what it was that we were going to play next, I'd tell you, but I can't.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Fingal's Cave podcast. My name is Kyle Viveros. Tonight's episode is the finale of our journey into the solo career of Roger Waters, covering the period from 2010 to 2026. Before we get into this episode, we once again would like to reiterate. If you're one of those I love Pink Floyd but can't stand Roger's politics people, you might do well to stick around, because we aren't going there. If you're looking for political opinions on a Pink Floyd history podcast, you're in the wrong place. This episode is largely to focus on the music, the memories, and the context behind these tours and the excellent musicians that took part in them. So let's go down to Studio B with Adam, Mike, and Nils. And now, the year is 2010. Roger begins touring the Wall as a proper piece of stage theater. Not just in Berlin, not just in 30 shows across four cities, the entire world. It is without a doubt probably the biggest tour he ever put on in terms of production, in terms of staging. Of course, the personnel, we have Roger, he's always there, G.E. Smith, Dave Kilmister, Snowy White, Graham Broad, John Karen, Harry Waters, Robbie Wyckoff, John Joyce, Kip Lennon, Mark Lennon, and Pat Lennon. It is interesting to note that John Joyce is one of the original vocalists from the Wall tour. He last performed with Roger in 1987 on the Radio Chaos tour for the one-time performance of Outside the Wall, which I think it's a beautiful version of that song. I wish there was more like it. And, of course, Harry Waters, who has his connection to the Wall as being the voice that says, "Look, Mommy, there's a little airplane up in the sky on Goodbye Blue Sky." So it's interesting that now, after all this time, he is playing this material. And I always wondered how he felt about that. The set list for these shows, well, you must be kidding. There's no encores, there's nothing unique. The only addition is The Ballad of Jean-Charles de Mezzanine, which was played from June 2011 onward. What can you say about The Wall? It's The Wall. We play it from start to finish. But I'm of the belief that this tour, without a doubt, influenced the other two Roger tours to come. This is, I think, for me, in terms of all the versions of The Wall, listening to the live album specifically and watching the documentary film specifically, if I'm going to listen to a version of The Wall, this is good. It won't be this one that I listen to. It'll probably be 1980 or 1981 or Studio, and I'm certainly not listening to Berlin all that often. But I still think there are things that are very good. To point out right away, there is a long-standing rumor, I can't remember if it's been confirmed or not, that Roger showed a edited version of the original Wall tour to his entire touring band to show them what it looked like back when Pink Floyd did it. And this raises the question, where is that video, Roger? Roger has equated it to being like watching old home movies that don't mean anything to anyone else other than him. In the Chaos Tour, he's talked about stamping out any possibility of doing a video as it does not do justice to a very theatrical event. And I would say, to some degree, the documentary film still doesn't convey that in quite a few ways. But for someone who wasn't there, Adam, as I understand it, you decided not to tour, or not to join in on seeing this tour.
Yeah, not only did I not see it, I not saw it twice in Minneapolis. So despite like not even traveling to go see a show, first of all, I couldn't believe that he actually decided to tour this, right? And it was an immediate visceral reaction of, this is a man who felt so compelled about his reaction to a large audience that he wrote and designed and, you know, created this masterwork about alienation, and he's going to go schlep it around the world. I couldn't do it. And everyone's like, I don't understand why you're not going to go see this. I'm like, This is really like the most anti Roger Waters thing Roger Waters could do. I'm like, I'm not going to go. Right. And then like I think the first leg of the tour, he came through Minneapolis, didn't go, you know, was kind of edgy about it. And then he puts on more dates and he comes to St. Paul and I'm like, I should probably go. And I'm like, I can't do it. Like, I just can't do it. You know, and did I listen to shows? Sure. Did I go see the movie when it came out in the movie theater? Sure. Did I go buy, you know, the album? Yeah. Have I listened to it? Yeah. Do I regret it? I don't think I regret it. I've had a lot of people tell me I'm really, really wrong for not going to see it, but it just felt wrong to me. I'll take your shots now.
I'm not going to shoot you. First of all, some more numbers. He did 219 shows and he made almost $1 billion in turnover. So if you need a reason why he did it, here we go. I didn't think about all that, to be honest, because at that point I did not expect anything from Roger from 1980 in comparison to 2010. I think he was far beyond that already. I was in Spain on holiday and had to go back to Düsseldorf to see it with my best friend and then go back to Spain. So it was a really special trip. And I have to admit, I cried the whole time. From the beginning to the end, because I was so overwhelmed by the light, by the aesthetics, by the show, the trajectory, everything was just great. And I think the wall was something to see live at the moment and not to think about it ever again. It was just like the perfect cocktail, the perfect summer night, whatever you call it. The same problem here, bootleg from day one to the last day, of course, almost the same. Being there, I was so overwhelmed. It was such a great joy, and everyone in the audience, at least in Germany, was so flabbergasted. It was just magic.
This is something I never ever thought I would see live. I've been collecting Floyd stuff since the early 90s, and even the Wall live stuff, there's the sort of grainy videos and that's about it. So you don't really get to see a whole lot of this stuff in person with your own eyes. And to me, it was more about, holy crap, can Roger pull this off? Because I've been told up to this point as a fan, this thing is untourable. Now I realize the technology's improving ever and all that, but I was going out of curiosity, but I was definitely hesitant because I was worried that it was going to tarnish the legacy of the show. And so I ended up seeing two shows on the 2010 leg, one in Vancouver, one in Tacoma in December. And then I saw one in Seattle in 2012. And then I saw it in Vancouver again in 2012 in May. But that was the stadium version, which he adapted in 2012. So I got to see three of the arena shows, which were like catered for the hockey, basketball arenas. And then I saw one for football stadium. And the football stadium version was astonishing. It blew my mind. I took my dad and my brother. My dad's not a Pink Floyd fan. I'm like, Dad, you need to see this. Like, we're gonna go sit in the front and you're gonna watch this thing. His brain couldn't comprehend what was happening at any one time. It was overwhelming. Massive risk, massive undertaking for Roger to put this on the road. Massive success. I mean, Nils mentioned some numbers. Like, it's the 18th highest grossing tour of all time still. Like, that is mind-boggling. He played over 200 shows of The Wall, did 4 years of touring between 2010 and 2013. His band was great. For this show in particular, you don't want improvisation on The Wall. That's not what you're seeing it for. So Kilminster actually fit perfectly. And I think having somebody like G.E. Smith, who had been the band leader for Saturday Night Live band for all those years, having him play the Gilmore part of being the conductor, essentially, was perfect for this show. The visuals, the stuff they could do on The Wall, like, it wasn't projectors anymore. It was, you know, LED. It was, you know, digital. It was amazing. I think of all the parts that I love about the show were just that much better. The what shall we do now with The Wall sort of whiplashing and cutting the guy's head off and it falls down, or you know, the trial. I remember the trial just blowing me away because it's pitch black in the arena and the projections look great and it sounds perfect. This is an amazing, amazing event. And I'm very glad that I saw it the times I did, and I will never forget it.
All I heard was you went to see it in a stadium in Canada and somehow you didn't think that was ironic.
It is.
Just because Mike is mentioning it, it was the same for me. The Esprit Arena in Düsseldorf, is a soccer stadium, and they cut the stadium in half on the length. So we had something like 110 meters. I don't know how much feet, but it's something like 300, I would say. 350. It was just, you couldn't see all of it at the same time. So big was it.
I find it so interesting that there's the mention of the visual side and how that works to the effect of making the wall work. I do like the constant use of the projections on the wall to some degree. There's some parts where it works really well. One of the things that was realized with this tour that was in the original manuscript for the wall is during the last few bricks, having photos being mapped to the individual brick faces, and they peel away and they come back. That stuff is brilliant. And I think that because that was part of Roger's concept from the very beginning on what he wanted to do visually, I think it's a very effective visual. But I also feel like the moments where everything is dark and it's quiet and there's no projections and you're just focusing on the band and they're getting, you know, smaller and smaller, you kind of lose that in the visual array, which sort of goes back to what you're saying, Adam, about touring this thing that wasn't designed to be in stadiums. It sort of ruins that illusion. But at the same time, I almost don't care in that respect. I almost don't care because, again, Roger is trying something new. He's trying these innovations. You know, Gerald Scarfe returns to redesign all the characters, and that's a big push for Scarfe's art. I think this is the first tour he brings on the local school kids to do choreography during Brick 2. To what effect that's good or bad is up to the viewer. I personally think it's sometimes good, sometimes a little too much. It depends on what you're focusing on when you're looking at these shows. I think, for example, on the stuff I really like, Another Brick 3, with the TV smashes across the wall and it's these blinding flashes and all the flashes of politics and news and commercials, and it feels so forced against you and in your face. But I love that about that particular song. There's an angst and an anger to it that I think is conveyed incredibly well. The last few bricks, again, with the individual images and bricks peeling away into space. And the way that they do Goodbye Cruel World is the opposite, I think, of the way they did in 1980 and 81. When Roger says the last line in Goodbye Cruel World, the light goes out and then they push the brick in. So it looks like in shadow, the wall is completed. Instead of seeing the bricklayers in light pushing the last brick in, which sort of, I mean, it's part of the clunkiness of the original shows that we talked about at length when we talked about the wall shows. Bring the Boys Back Home, I think, is very powerful. That Eisenhower quote, and again, the arrangement being used again from 2006, it's beautiful. And also Vera, recontextualizing Vera to show people coming back home from war and embracing their children. That stuff's incredibly moving to me. But the trial and Waiting for the Worms drive me mad. They drive me up the wall. They're all reformatted, but they use a mix of stuff that's in the original tour that no one has ever seen since the original tour, and all this weird copy-pasting the backgrounds to make them ginormous, hyper-zoom-ins of characters. It looks wrong to me. I have a certain strange sanctity for the way that song looks. Is it impressive? Yes. Technically, yes, it is very impressive what they did, and what they did make work. But the lighting in some of these moments, and some, you know, of course, the Dave Kilmister on top of the wall with, I think, G.E. Smith, or no, Snowy opposite him, and G.E. Smith and that, when they're doing that together on top of the wall, that stuff's just, it knocks you out, just like it does when Gilmore does it. But that is to say, I have a feeling about Comfortably Numb, and maybe you guys might agree with me on this. Comfortably Numb, when Roger's done it, I don't think it's ever been convincing. And there's a reason why. And to me, I don't want to make it about Waters versus Gilmore. That isn't the point of this discussion, but I saw David Gilmour do it at the Hollywood Bowl. That's it. I don't need any other version of Comfortably Numb. It's just when you're there in that moment and it's him doing it and it, you know, goes through your whole body, there's not another version that can compare, I think, to seeing him do it live. And of course, that's no discredit to Dave Kilmister. That's no discredit to Snowy White. That's no discredit to anybody as a part of Roger's band. But inevitably, Gilmore playing it is so much more convincing to me.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, listening to Comfortably Numb, not having David Gilmour playing the guitar, is the most useful thing to do there's just no reason to do it because it's his song and it's for his way of playing a guitar for sure. But I would like to come back to you, Mike, because I totally get your point. And we had that discussion before when we talked about the later years of Pink Floyd, 87 to 94. I tried to discuss the point that David Gilmour or Pink Floyd are playing Run Like Hell on stage as a fireworks show, super laser, super song, and having a laugh and making fun with the back singers. And I was a little bit confused by that. Listen to the lyrics, for God's sake. And you're staying here dancing and having fun. And to be honest, it's exactly the same bullshit. Either you accept that this is meant to be something, then you have to treat it with respect and not doing that. Or you have to accept, and that's something I did with Roger Waters playing The Wall live from 2010, to accept that they are beyond that. It was important to him in 1977 or 1978, but in 2010 it's not important to him anymore. It's just a piece of music he wrote, and he wants to make money and wants to play live, and that's okay to me then. It's the same okay to me as David Gilmour having fun on Run Like Hell, considering the lyrics.
One thing we haven't talked about is what happened before this tour, which is Gilmour and Waters reunited at a charity gig in July and played a few songs together to a bunch of rich people who were donating money to a charity for, I believe, for the homeless. It was, you know, good cause and everything, but they played on stage. And part of the deal was Dave asked Roger to do this as a favor to help generate money for the charity. And in return, Dave agreed to play Comfortably Young on one of his upcoming Wall shows. So one of the things that was always, and this was publicly disclosed too, early on in the tour. So one of the things that was always on everyone's mind as we're watching this tour progress through the years was, which show is Gilmour going to show up at? I remember even going to the early shows in 2010 and wondering, like, hey, I live in the Pacific Northwest. The odds of this happening are next to nothing. But, like, you never know. There's a shot, right? And it was a really effective marketing tool. And I'm sure Waters was doing that on purpose. Because if you really break it down, it was pretty obvious where it was going to happen. And, you know, sure enough, it did. And seeing the video, and there's a bunch of videos. There's professional videos. There's behind-the-scenes videos. But seeing those videos from London from May 12th, it's hard not to get emotional seeing that. Even the end where there, I always watch that one of Outside the Wall where Mason comes up as well. I think that's a great video. It's probably right at the end of when they were all sort of friendly with each other again, and then it all fell off a cliff again. But that was sort of, you know, it's hard not as a fan not to have a tear come to your eye when they're all saying goodbye and walking off stage while Outside the Wall's happening, and then Waters puts his arms around Gilmour and Mason and says, and from us, thank you. And they walk off as a trio. Wonderful, wonderful moment.
Right. That is a very powerful moment. And again, it's so crazy that this is really the last interaction that these three guys have on stage together. And while Roger's on this tirade about how much of a prick he used to be, and, you know, he was this brooding, whatever have you, Gilmour's just nodding his head yes. It is so funny to watch in real time, and it's such a great moment. There's one of the shots backstage you mentioned, Mike, where you could hear the trial in the background and Gilmour's getting his instrument on. He turns to Nick Mason and mouths the words, "Urge to defecate." Gilmour used to sing as the judge from time to time on the Wall tour, so he's having a flashback to that moment where he used to do that all those years ago. It's maybe not. Maybe in that moment he was just trying to be a goofball backstage. I've never known David Gilmour to be much of a goofball, neither Waters, but I think it is interesting to note that it is the last full Pink Floyd reunion we get with the surviving members, and unfortunately, maybe ever will have. Given the climate about the things we won't talk about and the things that we have, it's never going to happen again.
Can I throw a critique out about this tour? Because I have one big one. And basically, I don't listen to many of the later tour shows often because Roger couldn't help himself and added a song to this set that just makes zero sense. And so any of the shows from sort of the summer of 2011 on, you have to listen to the Ballad of Jean-Charles de Menendez, which is, you know, a fine piece of music, I guess, but it just breaks the continuity so much, and it's very hard for me. I remember when I saw the 2012 leg, I felt the same way. I didn't understand why he added it. There's these weird hybrid versions too, even before he adds the song, where in the early parts of 2011, they tail off Another Brick 2 with this sort of instrumental where you can tell he's toying with the idea of like, I'm going to put some lyrics here, I just don't know what they are yet. And then in June, sure enough, he adds this weird coda to Another Brick 2, which I've never understood the logic behind. If you're going to play an album end to end, play the album end to end. Don't make it something new.
Yeah, 100%. And I think I've been critical enough about, you know, about the tour and my feelings about it, but adding a song in to something like The Wall makes no sense. I was trying to do some research on the song earlier this week, and I found this great interview with Roger. I think it's from 2012 in Uncut magazine. And he's really open, right? And talks a lot about stuff. And you know, he had really good reasons for writing a song like this, right? And writing a protest song, and wanted to, you know, get it out to people, which I think is admirable and for a good cause. But like when I saw Springsteen a couple weeks ago, which was, you know, alt protest songs for 3 hours, like one of the songs that he wrote in reaction to police brutality was a song called American Skin, 41 Shots. And, you know, great song, did it in 2000, you know, played it a couple weeks ago. It's the centerpiece of, you know, this tour. But it's not like when he was doing his, you know, river tour, he threw it in the middle of the river. Right. So, you know, there's a place for stuff and there's a place to do new songs. And I was trying to think about how to bring that up in this episode. And you know what? If he felt so strongly to write a song about it and get it out in front of people, guess what, dude? Do an encore, right? Come out, play that, and play I Shall Be Released, or play Money, or, you know, play something else after Outside the Wall. It would have been really bizarre, right? But if you feel that strongly, separate it. You can't put it in the middle of the wall. So enough about that.
The only problem is there's no stage left. What are they supposed to do? Play an acoustic version of Money with their mandolins and Roger's flute? I mean, would have been very amusing, but it's like something out of a circus touring act when you think about it that way. And of course, I too agree, though, that the ballad of Jean-Charles de Mezzanine, it's not great. It doesn't add very much. I mean, of course, we talk about adding songs to The Wall. Technically, What Shall We Do Now was added in some way to the original tour. But that at least is from The Wall and is in its own little secular piece. Another thing to note about this tour in particular, there's a lot of multicam fan-made videos that are around. I think the best one is HRV's I Shoot, I Edit. Mm-hmm. It is the most full, complete Wall experience you could get. I remember when you could easily find it on YouTube, and I remember thinking, wow, this looks pretty good for a pro shot, ? That was the question in my head was, is this pro shot? No, it's just an excellently done fan shot video that shows off the whole spectacle in a way that's convincing. Unlike the 2015 documentary concert hybrid film, which, although I did enjoy, and I found a lot of it, again, there are parts of it that are very moving. Him in the car reading the note that he received when his father died during Brick One. That's a really powerful moment when you realize what it is he's reading, I think. I think it's a powerful moment, but you also get moments where there's all this tension and the concert gets going, building, and then there it is. There's the moment where he's in the car and he's driving around in the countryside talking about World War One and talking about death and the unknown and things like that as he's on his way back to the Anzio bridgehead, which is the sort of crux of the end of the piece. But of course, again, as I've mentioned before, Roger has this wonderful tendency to begin doing playback on these songs. And there's a lot of this tour that is vocal playback. In The Flesh 1, Happiest Days of Our Lives in Brick 2. Technically, Mother is partially vocal backing track because he's singing with himself from 1980. And they have the footage from 1980 up on the wall. What was with Roger using all that footage from the original tour in his PR and never releasing it? It's like he pokes us with his little stick. Hey, the Wall shows happened when I did them with Pink Floyd. You're not going to see him anytime soon. And then comes the problem I have watching these later Roger concert movies. I'm watching the show from my seat in my home. I'm in the audience. I don't need to see the audience crying and screaming during Another Brick in the Wall. I don't need to see the audience, you know, belting out the lyrics to Comfortably Numb or any of that. The only time where the audience shots work is empty spaces, and what shall we do now? Because the way where waves of hunger roar, perfect, that's where that belongs. During, is there anybody out there with the huge spots over the audience? That's where that matters. I don't need to see a woman in a bikini on the shoulders of another man rocking out to Brick 2. It completely destroys for me the enjoyment of the experience.
Yeah, first of all, I got a question, Kyle. Are you interested in the original ProShot movies of The Wall? Because I'm not sure about it.
I think I speak for everybody that we're all interested in seeing the pro shot of The Wall as performed by Pink Floyd. I think it's funny, though, when you think about it, that in 87 he says, oh, that we shot it on 1-inch videotape and it was pretty naff, and I'm stamping out any efforts to get it out. And at some point in the early 90s, there emerges the Earl's Court video that we're all familiar with, and it's like a hydra. There's so many of it out there that you can't get rid of it now.
The same way mocking you about that is, in my opinion, is him mocking us as fans with The Wall movie. I mean, honestly, what he does is just, he's killing it, creating tension, killing it. And you're totally right, there should be three versions of that movie. The first version, having the Roger Waters version playing trumpet, okay, yeah, driving a car with an old friend, all great. I don't want to watch it, maybe once, but then it's okay. I never watched the movie again because I don't want to fast forward these moments. So the second version should be only The Wall as the visuals with the sound and everything, exactly as you say, just like a movie, like the original idea of The Wall movie he had in his mind, playing live and having a movie about it. And the third version might be a Delicate Sound of Thunder style, showing a slow motion audience, having great fun. Could be great for anybody, but not Pink Floyd fans, I guess.
So here's a hot take. One of the biggest travesties of Pink Floyd fandom is that Pink Floyd, at their height of their popularity, didn't film any shows from 1972 to 1977. We all know that. This is on par with that. This is the most expensive show, that's one of the most expensive shows that's ever been put on. It is wildly successful by every metric. The film is unwatchable. You cannot watch a film of this tour and see the grandeur of the show from that movie. I find that movie incredibly contrived, borderline unwatchable for me. And even the live footage, it's not shot in a way that gives you a sense of what it's like to be there. The In the Flesh show, the way they shot that show, is it's like being there, right? You never see the crowd. It focuses on the playing. There's not a lot of cuts and camera movement. That Wall film, I can't even tell you how many times I've watched it. It's barely one or two, because it is not representative of what I saw. And the fact that that's the only existing document from this incredibly expensive, high production value tour is a travesty. There should be something better. I'm very grateful for labels like Harvested, like you mentioned, I Shoot, I Edit. That one's really good. The Take Me Out to the Wall game is really good as well. All these ones that exist online are far superior to this movie. And the live album, I can't even tell you. I never put that out live album on either. It doesn't sound good. It's not a well-produced album, and it's a real shame. There should be a better document of this tour.
Roger takes so many cues from the original performance. It's like he's copying it. He's trying to create. Listen to the way that G.E. Smith sings Thin Ice. The way that he sings Gilmore's part. And the sea may look warm to you, babe. Like the descending melody in the voice. Just the way that Gilmore does it in the Wall shows. The way that Mother's sung. The where he places his voice. It sounds just like the original Wall shows. But we already have them in audio form, you know? Obviously, you can't improvise with The Wall. You can't do extra things. There should have been a way to make it more conducive to a reimagining, but not quite. And for my money, watch I Shoot, I Edit, or Take Me Out to the Wall game. You don't need to watch that 2015 documentary film, because it's simply not, you know, it's simply not as riveting as the actual show is.
I think it all comes back to the thing I said in the very beginning. The Wall tour show was for the audience, for the moment being there. Everything else is just compromised. It's just not worthy. But being there, for me personally, was great fun. Even though I understand the reasons. I'm sad for you, Adam, that you didn't see it.
I will survive.
On the subject of things that Adam enjoys listening to, the weird Roger shows. We're into the weird Roger period of 2015 to 16, where he's playing Newport. He's doing several sort of charity gigs. It is an interesting period before we get to Desert Trip. I want to know what you all think of it, because it completely slipped my mind.
I got another hot take for y'all. The Newport Folk Festival show is one of my favorite Roger Waters shows of all time. I find that show incredibly watchable. There are a lot of great videos online. Soundboard recordings and everything. My Morning Jacket and G.E. Smith as his backing band is perfection. The version that he does of Amused to Death on the re-release date of the album is my favorite version of Amused to Death. It is perfect. And honestly, I love that album to death, pardon the pun, but that version is amazing. He debuts a new song, Crystal Clear Brooks, plays the piano himself, sings live, no backing track, sounds wonderful. I wish he would do more of this type of stuff. So if you haven't watched or heard the Newport Folk Festival show, please, please, please go watch it. That's what Roger Waters could be doing as a tour in a different world.
I concur 1,000%. I was so excited when he announced that he was going to be at Newport. I was amazed, you know, that it was, you know, broadcast. I don't remember if it was live or the next day or whatever. So you're hearing like new renditions, new song, him actually performing. I don't know if I had an opinion about My Morning Jacket. I still don't know if I do or not, but he had guests, he did covers. It was really like a whole different Roger Waters, right? It felt like a complete reaction to everything that he had done on the Dark Side and Wall movies. And remember, that didn't happen that long after the Wall movie came out. Like, I don't remember the exact dates, but they were pretty close to one another. I think up until a couple days ago, Mike, I was right with you that Newport was the standard for that era. And then I listened to the Sag Harbor show, which was like a month or so later, and it's just him and G.E. Smith. I think, besides the fact that that's what he should be doing for the rest of his career, right? If you want, I know I'd be bringing up Bruce a lot, but if he wants to do like a Springsteen on Broadway type thing, that's what Roger needs to do, is just go out there and sing and tell stories and have one guy accompany him. But Sag Harbor really sets the tone for his career from that moment on. He recites poetry. He does the new songs. He actually performs in a way and sets the stage for the new album and the tour and everything else that's coming. And, you know, the Redux shows are not good, but he's singing and he's trying something different. Same thing with the lockdown sessions. Like, he tried something different. I really kind of appreciate that in some ways. And then you get these other shows that we're going to get back to.
Well, I do want to mention for Sag Harbor and for the one he did in Washington, D.C., which at the
veteran stuff. Yeah.
They do a live version of When the Tigers Broke Free, which is great. I listened to that the other day. I was like, man, why didn't he do this more? This is fantastic. So, again, it's a weird pocket of shows that summer, fall of 2015. But if you are looking for something different from Roger Waters, like, that's it. Like, to me, there's a lot of good stuff in there. Highly recommended.
Absolutely. What's interesting then is then going into 2016 and going into Desert Trip. And I have to admit, when Desert Trip was announced, I was like, I don't see how this is going to be interesting or good or anything. I was really wrong, right? Like, first of all, I decided I wasn't going to go. I don't think I was as morally opposed to it as I was the Wall show. And then just through happenstance, someone offered me a ticket and a place to crash. And I made the decision to go out there. And let me just say, $600 for 3 days, that's like free to go, you know, considering who I was going to go see. So I was pretty happy about that. I don't know if we want to, like, Kyle, like, do his spiel about the show, but that may have been the best time I ever saw Roger Waters. Absolutely.
And as someone who is brand new to Desert Trip, as of when we were doing the research portion of this, I was floored. It is such a unique show in Roger's canon. There's not a lot of solo material in there. It pretty much is almost exclusively all Floyd hits. but they feel fresh. They feel rehearsed, but not in a way like the Waters machine has continued. Set the Controls in 2016 by Roger Waters? That's crazy. That's such a unique song. And he never plays it outside of Desert Trip, and I believe maybe early shows on the Us and Them tour, or things in preparation for that tour, which we'll get to. There's more traditional sound effects, soundscapes. There's it feels like a rooted Pink Floyd show. There's Great Gig in Full, very nice version of that. Money has, again, the full soundscape at the start. It feels akin to a 1999 performance in a lot of ways. And then all of a sudden, he plays Fearless. Fearless, of all things, a song not a single member of Pink Floyd had ever performed up to that point. What why? It's always the why with Roger. It's like, why play Careful with That Axe, Eugene, in 1977? You know, why play Outside the Wall once in 1987? Roger says, here's Fearless. I don't even know if half the crowd would have registered what that song would have been. And I think it's very unique. Roger, of course, as is tradition, there is vocal playback at this show. It's like I'm repeating Revolving Record. But the backing track for Welcome to the Machine has him say the words, his Jaguar car, the way he last did in 1987. I found that fun because I like that version of Welcome to the Machine. And Have a Cigar, again, gets a reinvention. I think every time Have a Cigar has been performed live since 1984, there's always something a little different, just a little different, or there's a key change. It's never been the same, and I quite like that a lot.
One of the key factors here is his band is kind of a hybrid band of the band that he had for the last 10 years and the band that he's going to have for the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. So he loses all the vocalists from The Wall, but he gains Lucius. So Holly and mm-hmm. Jessica from Lucius join him for the first time in this leg, right? So they bring a bit of a breath of fresh air. He's still got his old guard members, Snowy White and Graham Broad, on this leg. And so he's got a bit of the old and new, and I think it brings some freshness to it. Now, obviously, he's playing old cella, as Desert Trip gets called a lot, and that's, I think, why he's doing this Pink Floyd Greatest Hits set. This is really unique. He doesn't do any solo material on this set, like you said, and I think what he's doing is he's just, hey, I'm going to play your record collection for 2 hours, you know what I mean, of Pink Floyd records. Aside from Fearless, I think another thing that he does that's awesome is Pigs on a Wing 1 and 2 are bridged by the Snowy White solo. I think in week 1 of Old Cella they do that, and in week 2 they don't do that, which is strange. They do Pigs on a Wing 1 and 2, and then Pigs, which he hadn't done since 87 for the first time in this tour as well. The other thing that's worth noting here is the stage. The stage on this tour was incredible, and he brings it out in the next tour in 2017, 2018, but this is the first time you get the Battersea stage when the Animals material starts. And I can tell you, having seen that 2017 tour, the first time you hear the siren go off and the chimneys come up, holy moly, it's like, it's on, like you're ready to go. So aside from Desert Trip, I would also say check out the shows from Mexico that he did as prep for those tour. The one in Zacano Square or something like that, I can't remember what it's called, but it's in Mexico City. There's like 300,000 people at the show, and it is incredible. So it's well worth checking out.
Yeah. And it's filmed, right? So that was the amazing thing. So I was very much looking forward to going to the show once I had, you know, finally got the ticket and made the decision to go. I was under the impression that, I was going to weekend one, I wouldn't have to worry about spoilers. And then, you know, the Mexico City stuff came. So I knew about Fearless going in. The other thing that you didn't mention, Mike, was One of These Days. Like, Roger's never done One of These Days. That's not really a Roger song. I was so excited for Fearless, and I was so excited for One of These Days. And guess what? It really didn't disappoint. Like, it was really quite amazing. I didn't know who Lucius were. I didn't understand why these girls in blonde wigs were there and playing drums along with the band. And guess what? They were fantastic, right? Roger, yeah, I'm sure Roger did a lot of miming. If he was miming the bass, I gotta say, doing it in One of These Days was absolutely worth it. I don't even care if he was miming it or not. Like, him walking across the stage playing bass was simply amazing. The animal stuff was great. Watching, you know, it was a total shock, especially after 3 days. You got to remember this. He probably went on at like 9:30 or 10 o'clock Pacific time. People are, you know, exhausted. And then you just see the power station go up. It was absolutely mind-blowing. Amazing. I'm not going to get into the political commentary of what he did at that show. It was very relevant at the time. I'll just leave it at that. But again, like I said before, probably the best time I've ever seen him. Probably the single best performance.
And we are lucky enough to have two extremely good recordings from 9th and 10th, I would say. And we got from Ron, I guess. It was the Desk of House mix, extremely good. And the Dogs version is just two absolutely fantastic shows. And you called it transition, but we talked with Harry Waters a little bit about it. And we talked a little bit about it offline, because to be honest, it seems as Roger ditched him as well as the drummer at that time. So it was not really, nobody was sure about the lineup for the upcoming tour in 2017. And as I understand, they all expected to be part of the band, but they were not. So something must have happened then at that time.
I thought the recording was a huge surprise considering how well it was recorded, and it sounded just like it did. We were sitting on the floor in Indio. I'm amazed that something like that leaked out. I don't know where it came from, how it got to us, but I'm, you know, incredibly grateful for that. A week after, or maybe it was a little bit more than a week after the weekend two of Desert Trip, Roger does two nights at Neil Young's, no, I can't remember the name of it.
Bridge School benefit.
Thank you. The Bridge School benefits, right? He does that, uses essentially the Newport band, right? So there's change going on with him. And like I was saying before, I think it all stems from 2015. And, you know, it's interesting again that he does like these really big shows. And then for some reason, he's got to scale back and do something really, really smart. One last thing about, shocked that Kyle didn't bring this up. When Roger's doing Pigs on the Wing, he does a Dylan impersonation in the middle of it, which is hilarious because he has claimed to be, you know, a Dylan file for a long, long time. But, you know, he did, we mentioned Knocking on Heaven's Door they did once, and he's done I Shall Be Released. But hearing Roger sing in a style of Dylan was just, you know, delightful.
Again, I remember listening to Pigs on the Wing 1 and then hearing Snowy play. My jaw dropped to the floor. I was like, they've never done this. They've never played Pigs on the Wing like that. And again, ever since then, there's never been another performance of Pigs on the Wing as a song. And I think it's a very riveting, very moving version. But I will say, we have our discussions again about the trend between Waters and Gilmour kind of connecting with each other as the 2000s and the teens go on. David played One of These Days on his Rattle That Lock tour, and I wonder if that got Roger thinking, I should bring that back. Why don't I put that back in my set list? It's an old tune and people might like to hear it. I feel like there's some overlap or influence in that, but I'm not too sure. And after Desert Trip, we get on to the Us and Them tour. This was the first Roger tour that I technically was cognizant of, as the film that came out for Us and Them I saw in the theater. The set list is mostly comprised of the same old Floyd tunes, Speak to Me, Breathe, you know, Time, Money, all those other tunes. But we have a set of songs from his studio album, Is This the Life We Really Want? And to be brief about Is This the Life We Really Want, I think it is quite a good album. It's obviously no Amused to Death or Pros and Cons for me. I think it's a good album, but it works better in a live setting than it does in studio, for the most part.
I enjoy Is This the Life We Really Want. There's a bit of filler in there. Roger does a good job on this tour of picking the tracks that are the stronger tracks to play. Deja Vu, Picture That, Smell the Roses, The Last Refugee. Those are pretty strong picks to be on this tour. I think it's significant, this tour, because it's the first tour in 30 years that Roger's done to promote a new album. So it's pretty unique in that way. The thing that stands out for me of this tour, I saw it three times, I think, twice in Vancouver at the very end of the 2017 leg, the last two shows, and once in Tacoma in the summer, is the stage show. And I mentioned it earlier, their Battersea stage, that whole rig for this tour was just unbelievable. And I see this thing happening with Waters as his career sort of gets to its finish line, is that the musicianship that he's providing himself is going down, but his stagecraft and what he's bringing to the visual side of things is starting to really, you know, the Wall Tour, tough to beat that, Us and Them, wow, this is pretty good. And then you look at This Is Not a Drill Tour, that's pretty fantastic as well, and very unique. And so the thing I remember most about these shows is just that the stage show itself was amazing. And the Animals material in particular stood out for me very, very much.
I really like Pig's three different ones on this one. And I was quite critical about Dave Gilmour's there, but I have to say he plays extremely well. It's always very powerful. The last guitar solo are really, really good. Two things that I realized listening to the recordings we have, that they massively changed, or he massively changed Welcome to the Machine. So the last part of Welcome to the Machine is not that, you know, the synthesizer sound, but more like the echoing, which I like, do not like very much. The older versions are much, much nicer. And on the first shows, they have an extremely nice intro to Brain Damage, which they removed later on, which is also quite sad. And I have to admit, even though I like One of These Days, not having David Gilmour involved is also a bit useless. And I think it somehow does not fit to the set. It's somehow strange. I love One of These Days, but it's something is odd about it.
I went to one show here in Minneapolis. That was all I really needed to do. I agree. I think the new material worked better in a live setting than on the album. I thought the placement of Smell the Roses was a little weird in the second set. I kind of wish that it would have been closer to the rest of the new stuff. But again, when you think about his touring, and I agree that, you know, his musicianship has gone down, but, you know, the stage presence has increased. You know, he's talked a lot about how he's always reviewing film and, you know, doing tweaks and making changes. But once again, why introduce something new at the end of the tour? Like, it seemed like he got to like the last couple dates and went, oh, I forgot I wanted to do these songs. And the version of Wait for Her and Oceans Apart, I think that was like on the very last show. Like, that was fantastic. I never appreciated that song until I heard, you know, to heard it live. And I went, oh, this is really good.
I was at that show. That was the last show of the 2017 tour. It was a big surprise. But yeah, he did the Oceans Apart, Part of Me Died, Wait for Her medley at the end. And it was, he came out sort of on his own and said, hey, we're going to try something new. And he dropped that. And I don't know how many times he played it. I don't think it was that many in the next leg. He also does it the following year in the second leg of the tour. So they do Broken Bones in Copenhagen. I think they only played Broken Bones like four times on that tour, and it's quite good. In Lithuania, he does Bravery of Being Out of Range. He only did that three other times on that tour. And then in the South American leg, which is right at the end of 2018, they premiere Two Suns in the Sunset of all songs. And that was a huge moment, like for me as a big fan of that song. And trying to get recordings from South America is never the easiest thing, but there is a few out there, so that's good. And then in Chile, one of the last dates, Gunner's Dream comes back out of nowhere. And so that hadn't been around since, I think, 06. And it's quite nice as well. So yeah, if you're collecting, like, look for those later 2018 shows. There's a lot of good nuggets there.
Yeah, I saw it. I saw it live in Oberhausen, and I have to say, it was not as exciting as The Wall visually, but it was in total. It was a great tour, I would say. The show was good musically. I really liked it a lot. Yeah, I would say it's eight out of ten. Solid work he did there.
The Us and Them tour film that came out was the first genuine Pink Floyd thing I ever saw on a large screen format. They all roll your eyes at me, but that was my first one other than a Brit Floyd tribute band gig. I don't think that counts, but it was good, but it wasn't what I saw in that theater. And seeing it then, I remember being blown away by every aspect of it. The cinematography, the visuals, the One of These Days visuals with the light jumping up and down the hallway to the rhythm of the bass. Unbelievable. As someone who is starting to become a video editor, I looked at that, I'm like, that's amazing. Look at what he's doing there. And of course, being in the theater when the lights came up and the sirens and Battersea came down from the ceiling, seeing that live must have been a whole other experience. But even to me, seeing it in a theater, that to me, I think this tour might be the most technically interesting tour Roger ever put on. Because not only does Battersea come down from the ceiling and they're projecting onto that, something he talked about in the era of Pros and Cons, with multiple screens coming down and projecting things onto those screens, but then it starts changing and shrinking in size during Money, and it creates like a waveform effect, and some of them are taller and smaller. Unbelievable. I mean, just watching that in real time, it must have been... You, if you were on any substance or you were off your head, you must have thought you were dreaming in some ways. Well,
and same thing with I think it was that tour where he basically did the pyramid with different colors, you know, over the audience. And I remember at the time going, oh man, that's just so cheesy. And then like I thought about it later, go, I don't think that was easy to do, you know, but it was very cool looking. It was cheesy.
It was very, very memorable. I remember that part specifically of the show, and I remember taking a lot of pictures of it because I was like, wow, how is he doing this? So yeah, it was really cool.
They did something similar in 2006, I think, where they had a smaller prism up in the air and then there was the light coming out. Nowhere near as effective. And again, it's indicative of 1975, the giant pyramid stage that fell apart at Three Rivers Stadium. It's indicative of that somehow. Once we depart from the Us and Them tour, 2020, Roger is supposed to go on tour, and the lockdown happened, COVID, and all the shows got moved forward 2 years. So in that time, Roger ends up putting out the lockdown sessions, or ends up recording things for the lockdown sessions, Gunner's Dream, Mother, Two Sons in the Sunset, Bravery of Being Out of Range, Vera and Bring the Boys Back Home. I believe I've got them all, if I remember that correctly. Keep in mind the way that Roger does these songs on the lockdown sessions. Because again, Roger knew how to reinvent the older material, something he somehow forgot within the next 2 years. I think the lockdown sessions are great. I think Gunner's Dream, as he does it on that, is a moving, beautiful piece. I really wish he played that more live. I think Gunner's Dream deserves more play, and that might be just me talking, again, like you, Mike, and like you, Adam, as Final Cut enjoyers. And Nils, I believe you as well enjoy the Final Cut to some degree. But I think I wish there was more of that in Roger's repertoire.
It was probably one of the highlights of the Pros and Cons tour, if you want to be honest about it, because Eric finally got a chance to stretch out a little bit.
Yeah, I also have to say the lockdown sessions, for me personally, these recordings are the last usable piece of music from Roger Waters. And I really like it. I listen to it a lot. I listen to it more than the original albums or anything, because I really like the way they did that.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it too. I mean, I think the only part of it that is unfortunate is that I don't like the rework of Comfortably Numb. I'm not sure why that was necessary. However, I know we're going to get into This Is Not a Drill. I did think the live performance of Comfortably Numb 2022 was quite effective. So it's hard to sort of wrestle with those two, but I love the Vera, Mother, Two Sons, Gunner's Dream on that album. It's great. I do listen to it a lot as well.
I'm looking forward to hearing what the difference is between the lockdown version of Comfortably Numb and what was on the tour, because for me, I actually thought it was a fairly weak way to start the show, but we're getting ahead of ourselves because I think it was just all the same every single night. One thing I wanted to point out when I mentioned the uncut interview from 2012, there is a line in there where he said he couldn't see himself ever rewriting one of his songs, that it would be not necessarily integral to who he is to completely rewrite something. And then, you know, you fast forward another 10 years, you know, 8 or 10 years, and he's like, I'm just going to redo all these. Most of the songs, they do feel like interpretations, right? Comfortably Numb is completely different. I mean, it's a whole different thing. And we're going to end up talking about Dark Side of the Moon eventually as well. But something definitely changed in his psyche going, well, hey, these are my songs. I can do with them what I want.
Well, I always wonder if it's Taylor Swift and her re-recording her own songs to take back the sort of control of them. I always wondered if that was related, because it seems strange that all of a sudden he starts doing these things that seem... It's unclear what his motivation is.
But Rogers had complete control of the wall since 1987. All he has to do is give Gilmore a few shillings every time he does Comfortably Numb or Run Like Hell. He has control over the whole thing and the final cut. None of the other band members were interested in the final cut when they were making those debates in 1987. So maybe it is that Rogers trying to reclaim something, as we'll get to. But there's a reason why I left off Comfortably Numb 2022, because I refused to listen to it until I saw the show. I refused until I saw the show, because I knew I wasn't going to like it. But there's a reason why. The conceit of which Roger has done it. Roger swears up and down that he loves David Gilmour's guitar work. He loves the contributions Gilmour made to the music. And if you notice, with the trend going forward, especially with Comfortably Numb 2022, there is no guitar. It's to remove it and to say the words are the song. For me, and I believe I maybe speak for you guys as well, that's not the case. Why do we listen to Comfortably Numb? For Gilmour's guitar.
It's a car solo.
And like the beauty and the beauty and the sorrow that lies in that solo. And to take it out, to reinterpret it, although in the live setting, I suppose now we are into This Is Not a Drill, which is his last world tour, potentially his last tour ever. If the current trend of news, which only broke out in the month we've been planning this, is to be believed, this could very well be the last we see of Roger. But the way he uses Comfortably Numb to start the show, with him talking over the PA like you're in a Kmart grocery store, right? And then the blue light special comes on, and Roger says, "If you're one of those, I love Pink Floyd." Da, da, da. That sort of sentence that got a lot of us into a different mood before the beginning of the show. The thunderclap that completely cuts him off made me jump. And I think that sold me on it sort of beginning the show and the way that it feels in that live setting. And then at the end, that ascending cry into the Happiest Days helicopters, I think that was pretty effective as a stage thing, but not musically. I wasn't moved by it at all musically or visually, in fact.
I have to be honest, I quite like it because I like that it's at least different. I mean, yes, you're right about David Gilmour. I said the same, but David Gilmour's not around playing with Retro Waters. So it's Dave again. And having another Comfortably Numb of 7 minutes by the end of the show. No, it's just an offer and we can take it. We can listen to it or not. But I have to agree at the same time that the very first shows when they played that very slow guitar on Comfortably Numb, this is the best live version. This is really great. I'm really sad that they took that away.
This is the only tour that Roger's done since 99 that I didn't see. I had a ticket to this tour and I couldn't attend because I had to go away for work suddenly and I ended up just eating the cost of the ticket. But in preparation for this podcast, I actually watched the This Is Not a Drill film for the first time last night. And I thought it was quite good. Comfortably Numb 2022, I just liked the mood that it set for the beginning of the show, and I liked the visuals that went along with it, the sort of somber tone. Yes, if you think about, hey, what are they doing to Comfortably Numb? It's annoying. I'm not there, if I'm being honest, to see Comfortably Numb. I don't care if they play Comfortably Numb. I've seen it a million times. I've heard a million versions of it. So trying something different, I agree with Nils. Like, it's a nice change to start off a show with Comfortably Numb and to do it a different way. I also think Roger should be commended in this tour because it's clear he is doing some live vocals for sure on some of these songs. Some. So the bar, I quite like the bar, and he's very clearly singing the bar himself. And that is the type of song that 80-year-old Roger should be doing.
Exactly.
Is stuff in the lower register that he can sing himself, and I'm here for it. So, mm-hmm. And the last thing I want to say is, I really am glad they played the title track from Is This the Life We Really Want on this tour, because that's probably my favorite song on the album, and I was surprised they didn't do it in the previous tour, so I was glad that he's done it on this tour.
I agree. I thought it was great to start with Comfortably Numb and kind of get it out of the way. Maybe it's not my favorite rendition of the song, but in the live context, it was a great show starter, right? Listening to tapes over and over and over again, you know, it's like I this is just studio. I don't need to listen to it. It's kind of like On the Run and the, you know, 87 and, you know, 94 shows. Like, I can skip past this. There's nothing new or different to listen to here. So I like that. I agree. I thought it was a fantastic show. I liked him sitting at the piano both times, you know, doing the bar. You know, it'd be great if that was the Roger Waters show. That to me felt like the Newport and Sag Harbor shows that we talked about before. Like, I want that version of Roger, and he can play a theater, he can play a stadium. I'll sit there and watch that all day long.
So this was a tour I didn't go to, not because I missed it. I decided not to do that. When I saw his first announcement or listened to his first announcement of You Can Go Fuck Off, for me personally, I understood what he meant, and I said, yes, I accept your offer not to see you, because I fuck off.
What I respect, Nels, is the fact that you had an opinion about who he was and what he was doing at the time and made the decision not to go. And as a fan, that's a very, very difficult thing. So that you probably went through the same emotions that I did, you know, not seeing the Wall tour. And okay, during, you know, the last couple hours talking about this, maybe I made a mistake, right? But, you know, I'll hold to my convictions, and I think it's important that, you know, you hold to yours as well.
Yeah, I also really respect your decision, Nils. I think show up with your wallet or not, that's sort of the answer. And when he's sort of baiting people to say, hey, you can come see this or fuck off if you want to, you know, not pay to see that, I think that's what he's asking you to do, and I think that's great. I do want to mention, before we get into Dark Psychs, I know we're going to, that there was a couple of unique shows on this tour. In Paris, he played Broken Bones again for the last time. So Broken Bones, I think it was played in Paris and one other show, and then he dropped it again, which is a shame, because Broken Bones, now this is two tours in a row where it's a nice song, hasn't really got into the set list more than a couple times. So the show that they filmed for the film, there's two pro shot shows from this tour, I think Paris and Prague, and they used Prague for the film. And I know there's a lot of debate online in the community that they should use Paris, but in the Prague show, he actually kind of teases the Wall song Stop when he makes an announcement. If you listen to the audience recordings, he says, stop, I want to go home. And then he sort of twiddles off, and then he does his little announcement. So he doesn't sing the whole song, but he does tease it in the Prague show. And then obviously the tour goes all the way to December and wraps up in Quito, Ecuador. So that could be the final show of Roger's career, in all places, of Ecuador. So that's where he ended up.
For me, the whole thing about Roger's politics and the views, obviously we aren't getting into that, too deep into that. Again, I want to draw a comparison. When I saw David Gilmour, this isn't David versus Roger again. I'm bringing up what I observed having seen both of them live. Roger's show, great spectacle. I remember when the Powers That Be started, I was the only one in my entire arena who screamed, because I like Radio Chaos and I like that era of Roger's solo career. Part of me wishes he would have played something from Used to Death. I think it would have been very appropriate to play. I mean, he played Bravery, but I mean, It's a Miracle or the title track would have worked great with the show he was trying to do. You know, that sentiment that he has. When I saw him, and it was all the visuals and the seeing the violence and the woes of the world, when he got to Any Color You'd Like, by the time we get to that part of the show, I was crying, because Any Color is like it's my favorite song on Dark Side of the Moon, other than Brain Damage and Eclipse. And what does he play immediately after? I mean, I couldn't even see the stage when Brain Damage started. I was just, you know, but it was a very communal thing. Next to me was a gentleman who saw Pink Floyd in 1977 in Anaheim. In front of me was a guy who saw them in 1975 in Landover. And it felt, in a way, like all these generations of people were together in one room, and we were watching this theatrical, political thing that was meant to say something. And I can understand that. When I saw David Gilmour, I was loving the music and the stage and the band and the atmosphere of the Hollywood Bowl. And then he plays the one song that he played in that set that has the video of a soldier. I can't remember quite the context, but, and then it hit me. This is the only time Gilmour's gotten political in the last 2 hours. Oh, I really like that. You know, maybe it's because I'm a stooge for enjoying music over enjoying being talked to or spoken to. But I think that in a way, I prefer the us and them approach, where it is intertwined, but it isn't the whole thing. But I remember, again, when he played Outside the Wall, it was I stood up and I was just a mess. I couldn't believe that he pulled that out, and it felt like such a strong closer, him and his ragtag band together, walking off stage, finishing it up from backstage. I think that was wonderful. But the rest of it, I couldn't even get through the live album trying to listen to it again, because I thought, I was there, I saw it, that's enough for me.
And that's sort of the problem of the last, the last couple tours, right, is that there's no reason to listen to multiple shows, right? I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people that say, I can't believe you listen to, 30 different Wall shows looking for, differences or, Dark Side shows or whatever, but they're there. These shows are so structured, except for when they play weird songs, right, which I do love. I'll listen to the weird song. I don't need to listen to the, normal part of the set.
I will say, too, about the visual side of it, and one of the things that has increasingly bothered me, and I think, Nils, we've talked about it, Roger's use of Syd Barrett and what happened to him as a crux to talk about something. You know, with Shine On You Crazy Diamond, that's about Syd. Pretty point blank, it's about Syd and how much he misses Syd. But when you get to this tour, he was selling merchandise with Syd's face on it and like descending cubes, And I do have that shirt because I thought it was moving at the time. But thinking about it, you wonder whether or not, and this is a bold thing to state, perhaps a hot take, to what degree does Roger really still feel for what happened to Syd, as opposed to using it as a crutch to talk about everything else he wants to talk about? And the controversy with In the Flesh 2. And what he was doing within the flesh too. I'm not going to talk about the politics of it, but creatively. Roger says it's a part of the big theatrical thing. He puts on the, commandant's outfit. He does the thing with the machine gun. It's a moment of theater. Roger has fronted his tours with In the Flesh, or not fronted, but In the Flesh 2 has been a part of his set list since 1984. He wasn't wearing an outfit then. He wasn't doing a big theatrical thing. Same thing in 84, 87, 99, 2006 to 2008. He consistently plays In the Flesh 2. How true that is that it stays outside of the context, other than the shock and awe of you're at the Roger Waters show and he's pointing at you in the audience. There's something about that I don't think strikes right to me. I don't believe Roger is playing that song legitimately to shout slurs at the audience, but I think there's a disconnect for Roger in understanding that we're in a different time. It's hard to play that song in the modern era. He hadn't played In the Flesh in a live setting since The Wall, where it was a part of that big theatrical thing. Nils, what do you think?
I think that he started hating his own audience again, because he's doing many things. He's starting his show by telling us, or them, to fuck off. I mean, I would like to talk with you for a minute for the beginning of Sheep. The beginning of Sheep is such a great thing musically. And he's doing meh, 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 and he's imitating the audience expecting sheep. He's mocking his own audience. Again, he's killing it. I can't listen to this version of Sheep. I listened to the 2006 version, which is bad enough, but I can't listen to this version because he's killing it at the very beginning. And that's what he's doing on his latest show. He's still gathering everything from the tour, but he hates his audience. I'm absolutely convinced of that.
It's interesting. I never heard that brought up before, but I was taken aback last night when I watched the film and I heard him doing that at the beginning. I was like, well, thanks for ruining this, because you could see John Karen in the background. And John Karen has slaved over replicating this intro, verbatim, because he loves that intro. I've seen him make comments online about that intro and Rick's work on Animals. And so John's putting all this hard work to replicate it, and Roger's kind of stomping all over it. That's interesting.
Not sure if you're right or not. I'm going to keep thinking about it, but it does start to lead some credence into this whole, he does big things, he does small things, he does big things, he does small things. And maybe he needs to do those small things to reacquaint himself with performance, as opposed to maybe acting, right? And then, after this, he goes into the Dark Side Redux and maybe that wasn't the right thing for him to do. But the shows were probably, you know, were very interesting in how he tried to do it and considering how small they are. And he's done a couple other little, you know, teeny tiny performances since then. And I think that's, you know, part of the whole mystery of who he is maybe he does get to the point and he catches himself off guard going, oh, all right, okay, I've gone too far and I need to pull it back. I'm probably giving him too much credence. Maybe he's not thinking about it that much, but he does seem to have this pattern.
It's a thing you see a lot with in music and musicians especially, is this sort of like push and pull between I really, really want to be successful in love, but I also want to be an artist. You know what I mean? And Waters has got that for sure. You know what I mean? Like for every album, like Pros and Cons, where you go, man, there's no way this is going to be a mainstream appealing album. And you put that out, then he does, you know, well, I'm going to tour Dark Side of the Moon. You know what I mean? And it's this is weird. Like what are you actually trying to grab onto? Who do you want to be? Do you want to be, you know, maybe not Bob Dylan, because Bob Dylan is both popular and an artist, but do you want to be, you know, whatever, I can't even think of somebody off the top of my head, but do you want to be somebody who plays theaters intimately and can play whatever you want, and whether the audience likes it or not is irrelevant, or do you want to be popular? And I think, unfortunately, one of the things that influences him is he sees how popular Pink Floyd after he left became, and he feels like, well, that should be me. There's this sort of tug that he's always got tugging him, even though in his heart, he kind of wants to do these small things too. And also money.
Nothing. Let's talk about Redux.
I will say I almost bought into it the first time I listened to it. And I'll tell you why. I was interested, in hindsight, obviously, I think differently about it. But at the time when it was new and he put out Money as a song first, what a strange reimagining. It's like part music, part slam poetry, part music again. Interesting. How does he do this to the rest of Dark Side of the Moon? And then it came out and I listened to it and I said, yeah, he's talking the whole time. I don't have a problem with that on Pros and Cons. Not at all. Because there's music that you can hear that isn't just a drum going thump, tick, tick, thump, tick, dunk. You know, that really dry, stripped-back drum sound and the lo-fi drum beat that goes through that whole thing. And you know, that it doesn't work for me. And again, we know how Roger reimagines these songs and how he can. The lockdown sessions prove this. His prior tours prove this. What got me about the redubs is Nils, exactly what you said. He hates his audience. All of that. And then at the beginning of Brain Damage, he leans nice and close into the microphone and says, what if we were to remake Dark Side of the Moon? He's barely able to get the words out. It's like, Roger, I'm almost at the end of this thing. Don't mock me for having listened to it, because I won't want to listen to it again. And that got me. And ever since, other than to prepare for this episode, I never listened to it again. When I listened to it again, I'm not a music producer. But if you're working with a computer on a desk, you don't want to hear keyboards clicking or a mouse click. During Money, after Roger says, welcome to the Starlight Room, you hear him double-click on his mouse. This made it from the very beginning to final release, pressed on all the vinyls, put on all the CDs, and no one caught it? Roger's the most meticulous man in show business. Everything has to be exactly just right. Was that mouse click intentional? I don't believe so, but it takes me right out of it. The conceit of doing Dark Side Redux is to prove that he wrote the words to Dark Side of the Moon. And you will relish in these words that I have written.
I can do it because I can.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't think there's anyone that would say he did it because he should. Right. And I think that's the difference. I mean, I didn't think Money was that horrible when it came out. Kind of almost like the, you know, the lyrics to Free For being in Speak to Me, because, you know, it was all written around the same time. So, and it kind of fits, right? So I thought that was really quite clever. And then just you lose me. I mean, conceptually, how do you take probably one of the most revered albums of all time and completely redo it? And I'm not talking about one of those, you know, cheapy cover albums that people were doing in the, you know, late 80s and early 90s. Like that stuff's horrible. But this is just as horrible, right? The fact that it's his, well, it's not all his, right? You know, And I think that's the problem. I will never understand the story about his friend, the poet. I don't understand the stuff about, you know, the ducks and the live, you know, his live version of the album. It just, it makes no sense to me. It could have actually been something really, really interesting, but it's not.
No, it's really not. And I think part of it is the expectation. I mean, call it Dark Side of the Moon Redux and giving interviews telling the world that this is the real version of Dark Side of the Moon and the final version is very stupid. I mean, if he would have called it Dark Side of the Moon a poem or Dark Side of the Moon a private, personal, whatever thing, I can accept it. But I have to admit, in the last few weeks, I listened to it again and again and again for meditation. Don't laugh. It's a very good album to listen to when you want to calm down and if you want to go to bed, get away from computers. His voice and the speed is almost the same on the whole album. It's not changing. It's a perfect album for meditation or at least getting really, really slow in your head. If it's good or not, I don't know, but it is.
I mean, I'm not a fan of this album. I've listened to it a few times and I find some of it interesting, but do you all find the album more or less interesting than the two shows that he did, which I'm amazed we have recordings of, by the way, but I found the shows kind of non-events to me, but the album can be interesting at times. That's sort of where I'm at. Is that where you guys are at?
I don't know if I notice a difference or care to notice a difference, to be honest. You know, I don't think I'm going back to, I mean, I listened to the, you know, the first show, you know, with the duck story. And then I think things changed for the second show. And I'm sure I haven't gone back to them. The one bright side I wanted to point out about this whole era is I did make the investment on the live box set. And so I do have Roger Waters' autograph. And I told myself I never was really going to care about an autograph unless I got it. But I gotta tell you, at the end of the day, it's Roger Waters' autograph in my house. And so I'm excited about that. But no, yeah, the live shows weren't anything special. I think if you were in London and you got the chance to go see it, it probably would have been really, really interesting. And I bet in an environment like that, I bet it plays a lot better. It's nothing interesting.
Yeah, Neon Knight was at both shows and did the recording. And I had the pleasure to work on the recordings to make them fit for release. I don't remember the tracks. I don't remember. I worked on it for like 2 weeks. I don't remember. But I still like the album a little bit.
I think, of course, as we talk about Dark Side of the Moon Redux, we get into what's next. Roger's 82 years old now, you know? I mean, Paul McCartney's still rocking the world, and Gilmour just rocked the world a couple years ago. We probably are going to get the Bar album out of Roger, his memoir. His son is going to take his music on the road as a legacy band, and you, the listener, can audition to be the vocalist. At one point in time, I would have said, yeah, I can audition for that because I can't sing. Neither could Roger in the mid-1970s. But other than those few smattering things, we might have reached the end of Roger's output as a total musician or as a touring band. And I think in some ways he's been playing these songs for 40, sometimes 50 years. And I think he's given us enough in a lot of ways. There are more recordings of these Roger tours, video, audio, pro shot, whatever. We could listen to all them back to back and not be done the rest of our lives with how much there is out there. I think it's in a way him reimagining his first important work, quote unquote, his first important meaningful work. That's the perfect way to sort of wrap a bow on things, even if it is a little bit more of a whimper than a triumphant bang, so to speak.
I think that he is done personally. I have a minor hot take again that I don't think we're ever going to see the Bar of the album. I don't think we're going to see the memoirs. I think he's done. And you know what? Like, I'm going to take it all the way back to 99 when I first saw the tour announcement for the 99 tour go on sale and how surprised I was. I can tell you, when I, in 1999 as a Pink Floyd fan, I thought Roger wasn't going to tour again. I thought that was kind of it. And we got 24 years of touring out of this guy and multiple very memorable shows. And I feel like he's done a lot in the later half of his career, more than most people would do at that age. And I think that that's okay. I don't need more. Would I love to hear another album from him? Sure. But I don't have any belief that that's going to materialize personally.
I have a similar view. I think the Bar album will come out. There's no way in hell that memoir is coming out, right? Like, he's either got to be the slowest writer in the world, or he forgot that he announced such a thing. So I don't think the memoir is going to come out, and I don't know how truthful it would be anyway. You know, the Harry Waters thing I find very confusing. I love the fact that Nick did his tour because he said that there were enough, you know, Pink Floyd cover bands out there, and he wanted to play the material that they weren't playing. Roger, over the last, you know, 10 years or so, has done, you know, amazing job being the Pink Floyd cover band, right? And, you know, 2016 to a little bit 2017, you know, maybe the last tour, there's some highlights. He's done a really good job of presenting his music, right? And if he's, you know, tried to reclaim the Pink Floyd title because, you know, Dave stopped caring about it in 1994, okay, then guess what? Then he's, you know, made a ton of money and, you know, made us all very happy, you know, going to see his music. But I don't think he's going to tour again. Or if he does, please do it in very small theaters with just you on a piano and a guitar, Roger. That's all we want.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I can only second your final thoughts. The emotions Roger gave me over the last 30 years are tremendous, and I'm really grateful and thankful for every single show he did, and not every single show maybe, but most of them, and I still love listening to it. And we had that discussion before with David Gilmour. David Gilmour is a great musician, but when it comes to feeling, show, theatrical and everything, Roger was just my superior part of Pink Floyd, to be honest. And I hope that he will find a way for his own decency to the right things from now on.
Yeah, and with that, we've reached the end. This is the end, my beautiful friend. 3 hours of talk about Roger Waters. I personally, and I explained this to all of you before we spoke, I would be very happy never to hear Wish You Were Here or Another Brick in the Wall or Comfortably Numb ever again. I'd be very happy not hearing those songs again. And that's not to say that they're not good songs. They obviously are. But when you've listened to Roger's versions of them for this long, it does take a little bit on you, admittedly. But thank you all so much for listening to these editions of the Fingal's Cave podcast. Be sure to like and subscribe not to miss any upcoming episodes. Thank you and good night.
Thank you, guys. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.